Welcome to the Data Life podcast. In this podcast, we talk about real life experiences with data, technology, tools, and more. Wherever you may be listening in the world, welcome to this podcast. It's a tough situation in the world currently, and hope you all are safe. We really appreciate you taking time out to listen to this. We have a really exciting episode on our hands today. We are talking with Paul Azunre. Paul is one of the world's experts in the area of transfer learning in NLP and is also an author of the upcoming book titled Transfer Learning for NLP, published by Manning Publications. He also holds a PhD in computer science from MIT. He works as a research director in transfer learning in NLP and has also served as principal investigator on several DARPA research programs at the US Department of Defense. We're really excited to have Paul on this podcast, and it is going to be a lot of fun. We'll cover both the life aspects of Paul's experience as well as his tips on how to write a technical book, and also cover details on why you need to be excited about transfer learning with NLP. We'll also cover high-level details of models such as BERT, ELBERT, and ELMO. Without further ado, let's welcome Paul.
Hi, thank you for having me. Hello, everyone.
Paul, can you share a little bit about your background with the listeners and also how you got started in natural language processing?
So originally, I'm from a town called Bolgatanga in the West African nation of Ghana. I came to the United States to pursue my college degree at Swarthmore College, where I studied engineering. And then I continued to MIT, where I did my graduate work. So that's roughly where I come from. After completing my PhD, I started a company and got some entrepreneurial experience. I was applying some mathematical optimization methods to improve the efficiency of solar energy. And a startup was formed as a result. It got a little bit of an investment. And then, long story short, I ended up working on a DARPA project, a few DARPA projects, actually. They spanned areas such as automatic machine learning, you know, chatbots, cybersecurity, and those sorts of applications. Specifically, I was working with a company called New Knowledge. They are called Yonda right now. And we were trying to combat fake news and influence operations in elections of, you know, foreign nations, by other foreign nations, that kind of stuff. And in that context, there are a lot of applications for automatic machine learning.
Nice. Yeah, detection of fake news is definitely one of the main applications of natural language processing. And I can understand how working on fake news detection and stuff like that really got you excited about NLP. Is that also how you got into machine learning and transfer learning as well?
I resisted machine learning for a while. I think a lot of people who come from my background do. I worked in optimization, mathematical optimization in grad school, as I mentioned. And that's actually, mathematically, it's a very close area to machine learning, because machine learning, you can formulate that as some kind of optimization problem where you're minimizing a loss function, right? And then you're trying to find the best algorithm for doing that. It's a very specialized type of optimization, but it is optimization. So I was working more on the theoretical side of it and more on the design optimization side. So how do you pick the various constants in the solar cell, the various materials, how thick do you make all the layers such that, for instance, you reflect no light at all and you absorb all the light? Yeah, so I was working, it's kind of adjacent, it's not machine learning, but it's adjacent. And through this DARPA project I was talking about, I got involved in machine learning proper, as we today refer to it. And specifically, just to elaborate a little bit, I was working on a problem, so DARPA asked me to solve a problem, me and my team to solve a problem where we were trying to figure out what, for the automatic machine learning system, what type the input data is. So for instance, if the type, a string text string, because if it's a text string, the automatic machine learning system knows it can do some NLP on it, right? If it is an integer, it knows it can do some arithmetic on it. If it is a latitude or a longitude, it can put it on a map and try and visualize it that way, right? So that was the reason why we were interested in that problem. And specifically in that context, we developed a model called Simon. And this is where we are getting to how the transfer learning engagement started. So Simon was the model we trained to solve that problem. And the problem we were having is we had very little training data. And the model, the convolutional neural network needs, you know, thousands of samples to work well if you are going to train it from scratch, right? So we use transfer learning to learn from simulated data first, and then we transfer that knowledge to actual samples we labeled. And in doing this, we're able to reduce the requirement of labeled data to hundreds of samples instead of thousands of samples, which made it a lot easier.
Cool. So you were doing math and optimization and stuff like that. And through that, you got into machine learning and eventually into transfer learning with NLP. Cool. Okay. So can you now talk to us a little bit about your motivation to write this book, which is Transfer Learning for NLP? I'm very curious about that. And also how you got started with Manning Publications.
This model called Simon, it turns out it was almost identical to Elmo, which is perhaps the most famous, or one of the most famous models for transfer learning NLP. So we have exactly the same architecture. We did this in parallel with them. Obviously, their work is a lot more popular now. But after writing some papers and doing some talks, Manning reached out to me to try, see if there was, a book that can be written about this. They asked me to submit a proposal. I submitted a proposal. After you submit a proposal, Manning sends it out to the industry, and the industry comments on whether they want to read the book or not. And the feedback was very positive that they really want to read this. So that's how I started.
Yeah, I'm also excited to read the book. So, you have one more reader here.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So I think the audience will really appreciate if they could also understand, writing a book sounds like such a big and daunting task, right? Like, wow, like you are a book author. So I just want to break that down. Like, what is the process of writing the book? Can someone in the audience also possibly become a book author in future?
Yes, absolutely. The answer to the latest question, absolutely. And I hope so. The process is very much like writing a thesis, perhaps, except it's a lot more accelerated. So you don't have like a PhD thesis, maybe you're writing it, you're taking 3 or 4 years to write it, right? A book is probably a year. It's, on the other hand, it's longer than probably the papers you write, because maybe the papers in machine learning, well, sometimes you can spend years developing the theory, but it's not uncommon to work on something for a few months, discover something and publish it, right? So in that sense, it's a little longer. The process is very structured, so it definitely feels very daunting when you start out, but like most things, if you stick with it, it actually gets easier as you go. And publishing houses like Manning, the reason you work with a publishing house like Manning and instead of self-publishing is because they actually have a lot of infrastructure in place to lead you along in the process. So everything is very well structured, and you have a development editor who reaches out to you every once in a while to check how things are going. Sometimes, you need that to push you along. Sometimes it feels like overbearing, but it's exactly what you need, right? It's very much like writing a thesis. So there's a development editor who kind of tells you things, general things, like, who is this book for? Can you write that for me? And as you're writing it, you start figuring out, oh, okay, I see. I haven't really thought about it very carefully, but they made me. And then they say, what kind of skills does the person need to have? You start enumerating that, and in the process, you're teaching yourself what you need to do, right? Then after you go through the process, with the development editor, after a few chapters, there's a technical development editor who then comes in with a magnifying glass and starts looking at the details, right? And so, are you sure this is true, that Elmo, XYZ facts about Elmo are true or about Bert are true? And then you start, referencing, and they help you kind of lead you along, and then you get to the, the review phase where after maybe 3 chapters, TDE has looked it over, DE has looked it over, we send it out to about 20 industry experts, and they, you know, they rip into it. Some of them, you know, some of them are very critical, others less so, just like, right, you know, just like the paper review process. And, you know, universally it was true that at the end, when you finish the process, the book is a lot better than when you started, right? So it's a very structured process. It's definitely daunting. It's definitely a lot of work. I don't mean to diminish that, but I would encourage people thinking about it. If you have an area of expertise like this one where there's not enough material, please do this, because we all need it.
And basically, Paul is saying that you can reach out to him if you have any questions regarding writing a book.
I'll do my best. Yes.
Okay. So sounds good. Thank you, Paul. So one more question regarding this is, like, you know, such complex concepts like transfer learning, right? They are difficult to understand, but once you understand them, it's okay. Like, you understand it, but like explaining in simple terms for someone else is like another process, isn't it?
Exactly true. And that's exactly why you should, everyone should think about doing this. So for me, I mean, I understood a lot of the concepts about transfer learning before I started, or I thought I did, until I started writing it. And then, you know, I realized that, you know, a little bit of gap here, a little bit gap there, you know, I reach out to an expert, or I go reach out to the paper, I get into the details, and just putting this all together, and then, you know, explaining it to the development editor, who often doesn't have, you know, much, I mean, they've been doing this for a while, so they have enough to get it, but you have to really explain it in very simple terms. And until you do that, right, until you actually make the effort to do that, you won't find out that whether you can or you cannot. And until you can, you don't really understand it, right? So I think by doing this, you know, I improve my own expertise level, right, significantly.
That's a wonderful point. And I think I can add to that, like, you think you understand something, but when you write a blog or you try to explain to someone else, it's like you learn in another level. So that's why they say teaching is the best form of learning.
Right. Absolutely.
Great. So that's amazing to hear. So Paul, like, for our listeners who have never heard of transfer learning before, can you explain it at the high level? Like, how does it relate with, say, computer vision, and how and why should the listeners who are ML practitioners in industry be excited about transfer learning in NLP?
Okay. So maybe an analogy, if this is a good time for an analogy. So let's say you knew how to play a piano, right? And now you had to learn how to play an organ. Do you think it's going to be easier or harder for you to learn it than if you didn't know how to play the piano?
I think easier.
Obviously, right? And even if you knew how to play a drum, right? And now you have to learn how to play an organ. It's likely that knowing how to play a drum is going to make it easier, because maybe you know how to read rhythm, maybe notation, music notation, something there is going to transfer, right? But so human beings never learn anything from scratch. If they know something that's very much related to what they're working on at this moment, that's going to help them solve that task. Unfortunately, for a lot of machine learning systems for a while, that wasn't true. So anytime you had to face a different task, you learned from scratch. You collected data from scratch, which is expensive. You trained the model for longer, which is a lot more expensive from a monetary value as well. And your time is probably the most valuable thing, right? So it's a lot more expensive to learn things from scratch than it is to reuse knowledge. And until recently, NLP was not really at a place where that was true. So until recently, we were learning things from scratch, and now we're beginning to do more transfer learning. This is not a completely new idea, right? You have probably used Word2Vec before. It was pre-trained, and then you reuse those vectors in some other context. So you were doing transfer learning already, probably. However, recently, and by which I mean just within the past 2 years, this has been accelerated. The methods available to adapt models across tasks, across languages, across different domains, it just opens up so much possibility. From the perspective of applications, from the perspective of theory, right? There are a lot of the things that are not understood, literally. Like, this very influential field came to a head during the past 2 years, which means there's a lot of opportunity to make theoretical contributions. There's a lot of opportunity to apply things in ways that have never been done before. So, I mean, I'm very excited. I've worked in a few different areas before I worked on this one. Like I mentioned optimization, solar energy, systems biology, semiconductors. But I've never seen anything like this.
That is nice. In fact, some people in the industry are calling it the ImageNet moment of NLP. Before talking more about this, I want to give a brief background on ImageNet and how it relates with progress in computer vision. ImageNet has over 14 million hand-labeled images of over 20,000 categories, and it began in 2006 by AI researcher Fei-Fei Li. In 2012, a convolutional neural network called AlexNet broke all previous records in detection of the images inside ImageNet, and this possibly started the modern deep learning revolution. This was also the time when transfer learning got popular as people started reusing some of the AlexNet's early layers in their own computation problems. Improved variations of AlexNet are used even commonly today, and they are referred to as VGG16. So Paul, what are your thoughts about all of this?
At the time we had neural networks, right? We knew about stochastic gradient descent. And we had GPUs that people were using in the personal gaming market, right? But what was missing was some kind of data, right? One component that was missing, like a data set that was general enough that when you train the model on it, that knowledge was very general, right? Which what ImageNet became. ImageNet discovered sufficiently enough different types of objects and different types of contexts for them that it enabled a model that was trained on that data set to have general knowledge that was transferable, right? And when we combine that with some specific ways of fine-tuning the model so that you didn't have to train the model from scratch, but you could initialize it to something that was trained at MIT or Stanford on thousands of GPUs maybe, and then you just had to retrain a small subset of the model for your problem. And because the model was general, you could achieve state-of-the-art results even without having access to such huge amounts of resources. So that was the original ImageNet moment. Now, the NLP ImageNet moment we are having right now came from this unsupervised, or I guess, self-supervised idea of predicting the next word in a sequence. Right, that's something that is very easy to do. We have a lot of data now, like from social media. We also have constructed some nice data sets like Glue, Super Glue, and so on. General language understanding, that's what it's called. So we have these data sets, and we have a way of labeling them in a very systematic way. Right, predicting the next word in a sequence, a machine does not have, we don't need manual labels to do that, right? We can just throw Wikipedia at the model. We can throw all the books that we can come across at the model. We have the GPUs, which, because NLP is an easier problem than computer vision from a computational perspective, we definitely have enough computing power to do this. We have the data, we have the way of labeling the data. And now finally, we have well-defined procedures for fine-tuning. So getting a general model and just modifying a very small subset of it for your problem and getting state-of-the-art results.
So just to summarize, the way I understand transfer learning is that you can reuse initial few layers of a model trained on ImageNet and then use the same model parameters and train just the last two fully connected layers on your own small data set. And you can have something like, say, pizza versus hot dog detector up and running really quickly, which is pretty cool. So this is possible even though ImageNet might not have pizza or hot dog categories inside that dataset. You're just reusing the model's learning ability and applying to new scenarios. Also, the training data you need is very less, as the original model trained on ImageNet dataset has already seen millions of images and understood detection of basic features such as edges, etc. really well, which can be applied in your new use case as well. So the next question is, what are the possible applications of transfer learning in natural language processing? Like, what can we do with it that we were not able to do before?
This touches any application in NLP that you can think about. So we are talking about classification. We are talking about summarization, chatbots, question answering. If you are doing some kind of anomaly detection in text, you know, for cybersecurity applications, or if you are doing translation.
Any particular examples that you find really impressive in your day-to-day life about this?
So speaking about life issues, I'm from Ghana. In Ghana, we do not have Google Translate. For any of our local languages, there are millions and millions of people. There's a huge, economic incentive to do this. We even have a Google office in Ghana, but somehow we do not have Google Translate. You know, and if you think about it, like a lot of Ghanaian kids, they want to do something like that. But they don't have, you know, a GPU farm to train, you know, a model for days and days to achieve this. But now they can, right? Now they can transfer, they can do the transfer learning and they can reuse some of this knowledge and maybe do this. Speaking to some Indian friends of mine, and there are a lot of regions of India apparently with millions of speakers where there is no Google Translate for those languages, which is, Why is that the case? Well, you know, these models for today to do machine translation, you need, before transfer learning happened, you needed a lot of data, like a lot of data of language A, like English, and language B, like French or Russian or Chinese, right? So for those languages, the high resource languages, like the ones I mentioned, there's a lot of data, so that wasn't a problem. But for, you know, a lot of other areas, the low resource areas, anywhere in Africa, most of Africa at least, you know, a lot of other parts of the world, there's not enough data. So how do you do this, right? If you didn't have transfer learning and you had to train things from scratch, there's no way you could do this. But now, due to some of these techniques, we can transfer knowledge across different domains. So we can transfer, you know, knowledge learned from translating English to French, and English to all the other languages. A model, there's a variant of BERT that was trained on a lot of languages simultaneously to try and understand, you know, what's common in that translation process among various languages. So to make the analogy, I think this is the question you were asking earlier, like the cat dog classifier, it's learning in the first few layers which you are reusing, it's learning very general things that can transfer across these different tasks. Things like, how do I detect edges in an image? Right? And because that's a general thing and that's useful for both tasks, you can reuse it. In the same way, you know, if you think about the cross lingual transfer problem we're talking about, in learning what, you know, is general in translating, say, 100 pairs of languages, we can, you know, try and generalize that to a new pair of languages. Instead of starting in a vacuum where we just have to collect data for A and B, now we know, you know what? Maybe most of the time, you know, the first thing we have to do is group stuff into words, right? Just to make it very simple, right? A very simple example. Maybe that's the first thing that the first few layers learn. If you're doing a, you know, character level model where the sentence is coming in, the first few layers are probably going to learn how to separate or segment different words, right? This is word A and this is word B, right? And that is something that is likely to transfer between, say, English, French pair and English and German pair, right? There are words in both of those languages. That's not always true. I just have to make that caveat there. Not all languages have the same kind of structure. So, of course, it's going to be harder to transfer in those cases. But I hope I addressed.
Yep. I think that's fantastic. So essentially, like, again, to summarize things so far, like transfer learning, you can actually transfer someone else's parameter tuning effort. They might have used like hundreds and thousands of GPUs for over millions of parameters. And now you're just reusing them for the initial layers and just training like the last few layers for your task, right? And yes. In language, in an NLP case, you're learning about the grammar, about language models, how the words behave, tokenize, like those general high level things that a human speaker also understands.
Yep.
Okay. I think that's fantastic. You mentioned about Word2Vec and word embeddings earlier. I'm just curious, like, what was the issue with Word2Vec that we needed these new models and new kind of transfer learning?
Let's make an example of the easiest way to learn this. So let's think about a word like duck, D-U-C-K, right? It can mean the animal or the bird, or it can mean an action, like jumping under the table or something, right? So if you used a model like Word2Vec to try and vectorize the word duck, it will give you the average vector for all the possible meanings of it in language, right? And that vector will remain the same regardless of the actual use of the word. So when you were using it in the application that was talking about the action, you were using the average. And when you were talking about the bird, you were using the average. And there was no difference between them. And of course, that leads to a degradation in performance. Now, let's say you constructed a different vector for each of such contexts, right? How could you do that? You could do that by basically looking around the word and finding the context. Like if I'm in the part of the sentence where I mean noun and there are only two possible meanings, then I'll pick the bird because that's the noun. Whereas if it was a verb, then I know it's the action, right? And I need to look around the word to see the context to determine that. And this is basically what these models are doing. You can think about them as an enhanced form of Word2Vec, which are dynamic in that they change with context. And this enables you to achieve much better performance in a lot of different problems.
Okay, this was a really great example. I mean, this helped me understand like why we need this.
I'm glad. Yeah, it looks like I'm becoming an expert since I have simple explanations.
Now I'm like kind of curious. So I've been learning as well as I'm talking with you. And one of my questions is, how does it handle out of vocabulary words? Like if there is a word, because Word2Vec breaks down when like, you know, if it has never seen a word before, is there something that these models do better, like BERT, Albert and Elmo?
So all of these models, BERT, Albert, Elmo, Simon, they're character level. So the input is not, you don't tokenize it into, you know, it reads it at the character level, which means the vocabulary is all the possible characters, right? It's not all possible words. So Word2Vec has a vocabulary of words, and if the word is not in there, then it breaks, right? But BERT and Elmo work at the character level, which means, I mean, as long as the character is, you know, one of the ones in the vocabulary, it can do something with it. And because it's doing the convolutions across the different characters, I mean, even if there's a misspelling, right, it's able to determine that, you know, maybe even though these couple characters are different, overall is the same thing, right? So it doesn't break down, even if it's the character level nature of it, essentially.
That is really interesting, because if it has seen the word beautiful and it sees the new word called beautifully, I think it should be able to understand it, right?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
That is actually something which is pretty great. I mean, you know, otherwise Word2Vec feels a little bit brittle, and we have discussed like a few reasons why we need to improve. One is duck doesn't have any context. Then the second one is misspellings. Third one is out of dictionary words. So we have come up with some really great reasons why we need something
better. I should make a caveat though. Fast text already was able to handle out of vocabulary words. Because it worked at the sub-word level. It looked at the sub-word tokens instead of full word tokens. So that was an improvement on Word2Vec. However, these models are also an improvement on FastText, because FastText does not have the context.
Okay, thanks for the clarification there. Yeah. That sounds good. Okay. We will be back right after a short break to talk about the individual models such as BERT, Albert, and Elmo. Let's talk about individual models within transfer learning. So we have, you mentioned BERT, Elbert, and Elmo. Can you briefly talk about them? Like, why do we need three here? Like, which one is the best among these?
Okay, I'll address the various differences between them. So Elmo was the first one that started. Just like the other model I was talking about, Simon. It's a character-level convolutional neural network, and then it had some bidirectional LSTMs after the convolutional part, which looked around, as we said, looked around the word to determine what's around it, basically. So that model, I mean, it works very well. I still use it. When I build a model, I compare all of them, and some of them work better than others, depending on how much data you have and the particular application. It can differ. Very experimental. But Elmo, so Elmo, just to summarize, Elmo has the convolutional part and it has the BioSTM. Now BERT, then came BERT. And the other thing that Elmo does is it tries to predict the next word in the sequence to add that. Now came BERT. Now what BERT did was it replaced the LSTM part, the bidirectional LSTM, with something called the transformer, which is like, you know, the transformer, I'm not going to go into too many details, but it uses something called self-attention to effectively achieve the same effect of looking around and determining the context. Now, the reason why it was an improvement specifically is that model is a lot easier to scale on GPUs. So you could train a model faster and on a lot more data with BERT than you could do with Elmo because of this architectural change, right? And this was significant enough to like break anything that Elmo was doing. At the time, BERT broke all the records. The same way Elmo broke all the records of the things that came before it. Now, Albert is right now the winner. If you look on all the boards, Albert is the winner. Albert also came from Google. And Albert is effectively BERT, but they've done a lot of optimizations to reduce the number of parameters in it. And I hope you get a copy of the book if this is interesting to you, and we'll go into all these details and give, you know, code examples for everything. But this techniques that they combined, the parameter reduction techniques, led to a 90% decrease in the size of the model. So whereas BERT was 120 million parameters, Albert became 12 million. Instead of 120 million, it became 12 million, right? So 90% reduction, while, you know, maybe losing, you know, half a percentage points of performance on some things, right? So it was a good trade-off. And I guess that this is a very good time to stress that this is where the field is going. Basically building more effective models, more efficient models, more parameter efficient models. It's a big, big drive, research drive. So for people out there who are interested in something to study or an application area, this is topic. This is
excellent. So we have been giving work to the audience then, writing a book and also thesis. That is fantastic, right? Yeah. So I'm also like kind of curious now is, I've myself used Word2Vec and Glove word vectors and a little bit of fast text. When should, and they work pretty great actually in many applications, but like when should someone consider using these new models, or should they always use these new models for any new NLP task?
I think you should definitely make a comparison across all of these models when working on any new task. So I don't throw away the Word2Vec. I try that too. And the reason is sometimes in applications from an infrastructural perspective, it may be easier to do something simpler like Word2Vec on a large scale. That's really, you know, and sometimes, you know, you may have dependency issues or something like that. And sometimes the problem is just not hard enough to justify something so sophisticated, right? So, and the way you find it out is you do the test. You know, you have the function that does the hyperparameter search for each one of these methods, and you compare them.
That makes sense. So we have covered quite a bit of ground on the technologies here, which would be like, it was Word2Vec, then came things like Glove and Fast Text, which improved Word2Vec, and then came Elmo, which kind of broke all records. Which was then followed by BERT, which was like a big, massive, like 120 million parameter model. And then there was an improvement over BERT, which is called Albert, which is 12 million parameters, lighter, smaller. And what you can gain from these last three models is essentially things that were not possible with traditional Word2Vec on more complex tasks. In terms of complex tasks, you briefly mentioned translation and how people can build translation models using less data by using transfer learning. Is there any particular type of application in NLP that has only been enabled by transfer learning, which would otherwise be very difficult to do with traditional models like Word2Vec.
A big example is question answering. And question answering basically says, you know, if I have a question, I have a section of text, is the answer to the question in the text? Can you give me what the answer is? And And I mean, this framework, I should point out, is, you said chatbot. You can formulate a chatbot as a question answering system, right? Because you have, you know, all the possible responses to, you know, the question that the user is asking. And the answer is in your list of possible responses. So that's the answer you return, right? So question answering framework is a very general one, lots of applications. And it is one that's being used by, you know, to judge these models, because it's kind of hard. But it's also very important. You know, you can think about, I mean, there are applications in business analytics that I work with Dun & Bradstreet, and we have applications in business analytics that I probably shouldn't say too much about. The applications, I mean, you know, Google right now uses BERT. Did you know that? And this is a recent change. They rolled out a couple months ago. They just said they use the vectors to judge, you know, similarity of content, something like that, right? Because if you generate vectors, you generate BERT vectors for the content, then you can use the distances between the various contents to determine how similar they are. And that's probably what, whereas before they had some kind of, you know, matrix, at least the initial iteration of Google search, I'm not an expert, but it was some kind of a factorization method, an eigenvalue-based approach for determining, you know, based on backlinks, what's the most relevant page to another page. So similarity was a key component of it. Now, what I imagine what they're doing now is that, you know, they continuously train or fine-tune BERT on the content that they see, right? So the model is always, so, and that's important because, you know, words change meanings, like people introduce new jargon and stuff. So your model, you know, if you retrain it every once in a while, not from scratch, but, you know, in a transfer learning sense, which is not that expensive, then your model can be dynamic. It can be just capture the current state of affairs, and then you measure the similarities, and that's how you rank your content.
Yep. I think that sounds good. And even I think they started doing this smart compose in their emails and stuff recently, right?
Exactly. What is smart compose? Next word in a sequence, right? So language modeling, it's a language model. Probably BERT. Probably Albert now. Yeah.
So basically what I love about this technology, transfer learning, is it can democratize what Google is doing to everybody in the world. I think that's what I really like about this. Yeah, which is awesome. And to the listeners who might be in the field of, say, law or medicine, there might be a lot of text that you might be having, and having an ability to actually not just do command F, but also like essentially asking a question towards this text and getting an answer would be amazing.
Yep. Yep. And in that context, you know, when you download the model, you probably should fine tune it on the kind of language that you're going to see. So you, of course, you can try it. You can try it right away. It'll probably be decent, but you can get a lot of improvement by fine tuning the model, not from scratch, but in a transfer learning sense and in a very unsupervised sense on, say, law documents.
We will talk more about the book. I would like to know, what is the best way that you recommend the listeners to run the transfer learning code that they find in the book or elsewhere? What's the best way to start experimenting with these models and get coding?
Well, the book is actually written in a way to get you going very quickly without any GPU resources, even though you do need GPUs to train these models in reasonable time. So we use Kaggle, Kaggle runtime or Kaggle notebooks to do this. So Kaggle is obviously the competition platform where you can go and there's a lot of data and you can compete with other people to try and solve problems. And they have something like a runtime in the cloud, which provides limited GPU ability. I think about 30 hours a week, which, you know, has never been more than I needed to write this book. So it should be enough for you to run the code in the book. Everything is hosted in the cloud. All the data is on Kaggle and it's attached to the notebook. So literally within a few minutes of forming your account, you can click copy and edit and hit run. And you don't have to worry about dependencies. You don't have to worry about having the GPU, and it should be enough for you. If you're interested in using Colab, Google Colab notebooks, that's another variant of this Kaggle idea. It integrates with your Google Drive, and you can run, put the data there and run it. My personal preference is Kaggle. Other people like Colab, but we wrote, the easiest thing would be to run it on Kaggle. You could run it locally too, but then you enter dependency hell. You probably should run it locally. That's a different skill, figuring out the dependencies to install GPU drivers and, TensorFlow GPU. It can be challenging.
That is a great advice on using Kaggle notebooks or Colab for training the models, as you get a few GPU hours for free. If you don't want to build your own local machines for training, you can also try GPU EC2 instances in the cloud, say with AWS. So Paul, when should we expect the book to come out?
Okay, so it's currently scheduled for September. I anticipate it's probably going to be, December when it will be done. Just because, I'm just trying to add a little bit of time for delays. However, there is, we are doing something called an early release program, MEEP, Mining Early Release Program. And that enables you to get access to the book now at a discounted rate. And you will get, as the chapters get released about once every month or once every month and a half, you'll get it right away. You'll get a chance to, influence, which way it goes. If you think there was an omission that's really important to you, within reason, right, we will work on some clarifications you want to be made, there's a forum, there's a dedicated forum where you can talk to me and tell me about your concerns. And then hopefully this will end up, and at the end of the day, so right now you get access to the ebook and the forums and all of that. At the end of the day, you get shipped a physical copy and along with a lot of our gratitude for your help.
That sounds great. So MEEP is an amazing program. I can speak a little bit about it. It essentially gives readers early access to the book where you are given a chance to read chapters as they are released. And it's a fantastic way to really even work through the chapters, so you can really live reading the book as the author writes it, so which is pretty awesome. And Manning has made it very easy for you listeners to get access to this book. We will put discount codes in the descriptions so that you can get it at even more discount than what is currently available, especially for the Data Life podcast listeners, which is awesome. Thanks, Paul and the team for that. In fact, get a chance to win the free copy of the book Transfer Learning for NLP. Please share this episode on Twitter and add my Twitter handle Sanket107 and you'll get a chance to win the free book. More information about this in the show notes. Finally, I want to finish off by asking, is there something in particular you want the listeners to know about the book? And how does it stand in front of other resources out there?
From the perspective of where this book stands with respect to already what exists there, I don't want to, create the impression that this is the one and only reference that should be used by everyone and nothing else, right? There's a lot of work out there that's very good. So a guy called Sebastian Ruder, who is now at Google, who invented, ULM Fit, which was actually invented, in parallel with Simon and Elmo, right around the same time, has some very, he has a blog that's very good. He has, written a lot of academic papers that are good. Like Fast AI is another example, Hugging Face. So people should check out all these sources. What this book does, makes it different is that it pulls a lot of material in one place, standardizes it, and makes it more accessible to an applied person. A lot of the things that I mentioned before in a lot of these academic papers can be somewhat dense, right? And spread, all the different subjects we touched on, spread all over the place, So putting it all together in one place, making it accessible, attaching code that you can easily run within minutes, these are the selling points of the book. And once the reader reads the book, goes through this, introductions, they can now access this very dense you know, academic material. And I hope they do, because the field moves so fast that they will need to do that.
Cool. That sounds good. Yeah. Also, what's the best way for the listeners to reach out to you?
Yeah, if you are interested in my current projects, you can go to www.azunre.com. So just my last name. I mean, all this stuff, the book, so Ghana NLP, all of these various applications will be addressed. So if you go to my homepage, I've listed all the social platforms. You just take your pick.
Okay, fantastic. I'm able to see a lot of your projects, talks, publications there, which is excellent. And I can also find the links to your Twitter, your LinkedIn, and so on. So to all the listeners, you can find the best way to reach out to Paul at azunre.com. So this is really great, Paul. Thanks for taking your time today to talking with us and really like igniting the audience's minds about this exciting new technology of transferred learning in NLP.
Thank you so much. I've had a great time.
Please share this episode on Twitter and get a chance to win the free book. More information about this in the show notes. Thanks, Paul, and thanks to all of you for tuning in to this episode today. Stay safe and have a great week ahead.